With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk just a little bit about one of the really puzzling aspects of interwar kind of intellectual life, and that is the sympathies of Western intellectuals for the Soviet Union. Now, when I'm talking about Western intellectuals and their sympathies for the Soviet Union, by and large, I'm not talking about intellectuals who are actually communists. I'm talking about a whole generation of men and women, writers, thinkers, and artists who had sympathies towards Soviet communism, who weren't actually communists themselves, and by and large did not wish to see communism imposed in their own countries. The term that has been most ascribed to these figures has been that of the fellow traveller. And the fellow traveller term comes really from deep within Russian radical intellectual history. Alexander Herzen in the 1860s described America as revolutionary Russia's great fellow travelling partner. He said that United States of America was on a similar journey to that which Russian civil society that was growing within Russia during the second half of the 19th century, the way that it was emerging as well. So you have the Russian intelligentsia looking to a liberal America and seeing a potential future in Russia similar. And however, most of those intelligentsia within Russia realised that Russia, whilst it might hopefully take on the trappings of modernity, would have its very own different trajectory. So Alexander Herzen looked at America and said, really, we are fellow travellers, but perhaps embarking at different stops. And Trotsky resurrects this term after the revolution to describe Western social democrats who have sympathies towards the Soviet Union, saying, you know, these are fellow travellers, they may not be getting off at our stop, but it doesn't mean to say necessarily that we don't have to endure them. We have to endure them. They may be of some use. Now, the thing to note about Leon Trotsky is that, for the most part, he is scathingly dismissive of anyone that doesn't really fit in with his view of the world by and large, but also scathingly dismissive of most social democrats and those people that view themselves on the moderate left within European politics in the 1910s and 20s. So it's unlikely that Trotsky would actually have had a great deal of sympathies for the fellow travellers, but perhaps saw them as being useful. Okay. So let's talk about some of the key figures within what could loosely be called the fellow traveller movement. The British fellow travellers really are centred around the Fabian Society and, to a lesser extent, the intellectual talking circles of the Bloomsbury Group. The Fabian Society was really a product of Victorian progressive socialism within the United Kingdom. And the two leading luminaries by the 1920s and 30s are the ageing Sidney and Beatrice Webb, who have been pivotal in founding the Labour Party and writing its constitution after 1918. Sidney and Beatrice Webb have been on a long intellectual journey from the 1880s onwards, and they have come to the conclusion during the Great Depression, really, that the mutualism that the British Labour movement was founded on, the ideas of people like Robert Owen, who founded the cooperative organisation, and other such individuals, that mutualism of workers sharing, cooperating and building a grassroots society for themselves, they come to the conclusion that really that hasn't worked. And they also come to the conclusion that is presented to them by the Great Depression, that really the capitalism, in even a capitalism attempting to be benign, has failed. And this makes them more sympathetic towards the Soviet Union. Initially, when they looked upon the Soviet Union in the immediate aftermath of the revolution, what they saw horrified them. What they saw was a mass outbreak of workers' councils, of Soviets, of the workers making decisions, and that to them seemed like anarchy. Both of them were prize bureaucrats. They believed that a utopian society of the future would be a scientifically ordered, modelled and measured, structured system where a top-heavy bureaucracy would really arrange the lives of the people below them in a sensible manner. And this does smack of a certain kind of liberal elitism from the pair of them. They both look down on the working classes really as a quite dangerous rabble. And the idea of a workers' state sounds good, as in a state for workers managed by a bureaucracy. But a state run by workers, that's less attractive to them. And when Stalin manages to build a Soviet society within Russia during the five-year plans, this automatically becomes more appealing, and some of their misgivings are swept away. A far more ordered solution to the problems that modernity has thrown up of unemployment, of waste, and of the kind of cultural degradation that both Sidney and Beatrice Webb looked at in the West and abhorred. Stalinism seems to tick all those boxes. And when the two of them decide to visit the Soviet Union and write an account of what they see, they publish a book called Soviet Communism. The two of them travel to the Soviet Union in 1932 and were able to draw some conclusions about the country. They were guided around by the Intourist agency and shepherded away, obviously, from places that the government didn't wish them to see. Now, to see a gulag, one would have to have travelled quite a long way. Unlike Nazi Germany, where places like Dachau were available to the general public via tram or bicycle ride, the gulags had obviously been situated, for the most part, so far away in the vast interior of the country that it would have been incredibly difficult to get to one of them anyway, and the trains carrying prisoners were largely moved around at night, and special care was taken that these trains were their cargo was never fully disclosed. So it would have been difficult anyway to have uncovered much of the truth of Stalin's Russia. But also, if you happen to be an elderly couple being chaperoned around the country by very vigilant in-tourist guides and no doubt GPU agents, it's largely going to be a failed exercise. But this is to let Sidney and Beatrice off the hook slightly too easily. The pair of them had received numerous accounts from Western journalists and intellectuals whilst they were in Great Britain, before they had decided to go to the Soviet Union, and whilst they were planning to go to the Soviet Union, of purges, show trials, labour camps and the like. And so they were not ignorant of what Stalin had been doing, but set out really with a manifesto between the pair of them to find justifications for Stalinism. And quite unsurprisingly, they come back and publish a book that says that ultimately there is some cost, some human cost of Stalinism, but the gains are immense. And they both, when the show trials in between 36 and 38 happen, are absolutely adamant that if the people in question, such as Bukharin, etc., were on trial, then they must have done something wrong. And that a few eggs will probably have to be broken to make a glorious omelette. Their partner in crime was the great playwright George Bernard Shaw. And George Bernard Shaw had not only praised Soviet communism on his visit to the country, but had also expressed sympathies towards fascist Italy. Now, obviously, Shaw wasn't alone in having these kinds of views of Mussolini's new state. In fact, even the likes of Winston Churchill had thought that what Mussolini was doing was quite impressive. On the surface of things, both the five-year plans and Mussolini's corporatism did appear to be exactly the sort of medicine that the Western world, reeling from the effects of economic downturn and the aftermath of the First World War, kind of needed. But if you are to obviously pay any attention at all to what was really happening in Italy and in Russia, not only were the basic statistics about standards of living and that kind of thing largely falsified, and there is very little evidence that in either country the conditions of the ordinary people were particularly improving, but obviously, particularly in the Soviet Union, it's based on slavery. And in the in fascist Italy, it's based largely on kind of dysfunctional economic calculations that when one gets to war, in obviously the 1940s, the weaknesses of fascist Italy are revealed. Anyway, George Bernard Shaw, again, at the end of his career, was an enormous egotist, really. An enormous egotist who had had perhaps one of the most glowing and successful writing careers of the Edwardian era. He and H.G. Wells, another fellow traveller, sparred off one another, and yet both were the kind of the great intellectual literary figures of the day. And yet, by the late 1930s, there was a huge clamour from the Soviet Union for people like Shaw and Wells to visit. Not only does it lend a certain kind of intellectual cachet and legitimacy to the regime, but there was a desire, and this is not just from the state, this is not just an offshoot of official state Stalinism, but from many levels of society, there was a desire for some kind of validation for the great social experiment that's going on within the Soviet Union to be recognised by these heavyweight figures from abroad. In America, there is a wide and diverse range of voices in favour of the Soviet Union. When you examine the various ambassadors and foreign emissaries from the Roosevelt administration, you see an established tradition of sympathy towards the Soviet Union. The one anti-communist amongst them, William Bullitt, is replaced by the very very wealthy, though he married his money, very wealthy Joseph P. Davis, who wrote a book and even had a film that's used for wartime propaganda purposes, his Mission to Moscow, made in 1941. Davis was very enamoured by Stalin and very flattered at the opportunity to meet the great man. And Davis also acted as an intermediary between Stalin and Henry Ford. And Stalin was very keen on having the Americans, and particularly Ford, build motor plants, auto plants within the Soviet Union. And in return, Stalin could pay in gold. Obviously, much of this gold was coming from Kolyma and other slave labour camps in Siberia. and was it was a very useful way of creating foreign currency credits in order to have inward investment from the USA in the Soviet Union. But by the mid-1930s, the early 1930s, I beg your pardon, there was this curious phenomenon, particularly from America, of not just well-heeled literary intellectual figures, but ordinary working people making an exodus to the Soviet Union. The American economy is mired in economic crisis. There are a few who travel for as part of a kind of a working class radical political pilgrimage. But many go because they believe that there's work in the Soviet Union. And much as kind of as in The Grapes of Wrath, as Tom Joad and his ilk travelled to California looking for work, some people, 100,000 of them or thereabouts, got on ships and travelled to the Soviet Union, believing that there would be work there. There were a few, notable black Americans who travelled to the Soviet Union.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Soviet Union. Again, some of these had already joined the Communist Party, the Communist Party of the USA, particularly Harry Hayward. And if you get the opportunity, read Harry Hayward's biography, Black Bolshevik. It's a very, very revealing account of his conversion to Soviet communism as a result of American racism and his experience as a soldier in World War One and the discrimination he finds thereafter. It's a fascinating account. One of the most celebrated cases was that of Robert Robinson, who is a Trinidadian auto worker who was a naturalised American, who'd gone to the Soviet Union as a Ford employee and stayed there to work. His pay was far better and he was really enamoured with the zero tolerance at that time for racism within the Soviet Union, a far cry from what he'd come from. He was a victim of a racist attack actually in Stalingrad, where two white American auto workers attacked him, and they were both put on trial. There was a huge publicity campaign, part of it led by the state, but part of it actually quite spontaneous as well, from factory organisations who looked upon the two American auto workers as the kind of the dysfunctional product of a capitalist and therefore probably racist society. And there was a sense that, well, these people know no better. This is, of course, the instinctive thing that anyone that grows up in white American society is going to do. But Robert Robinson himself became a pin-up for this sense of worker solidarity. This isn't to say that there isn't racism in the Soviet Union, as many of the emigres would later find out. Of course there was. But for Robinson's purposes, he is well looked after and actually becomes a member of the Moscow Senate. Robinson tried to go home and found himself blacklisted by Henry Ford from every motor plant in the USA. And he discovered that he'd become a cause célèbre within the US newspapers as the kind of the love affair with the Soviet Union in the 1930s tapers off slightly. And Robinson is viewed as this nightmare that American society, the idea of an uppity Negro who's now discovered communism too. The irony was, of course, that Robinson wasn't a communist, and if he had adopted any communist views at all, it was really now because he was fairly stranded in a communist society and needed to kind of embrace the prevailing ideology in order to get on. And he's quite a remarkable figure because he actually stays in the Soviet Union all the way through the war and is in Moscow when the German army is on the outskirts and obviously would have probably faced, along with a great many other people, a fairly unpleasant end had they been able to advance any further. Another example of the American fellow traveller community, perhaps again at a slightly more kind of intellectual elite level, is that of Frieda Kirchwey, who was the editor of The Nation magazine, which is America's, along with The New Republic, its liberal left publication after World War One. And The Nation magazine had campaigned on various issues. It was her particular issues before she became a supporter of the Soviet Union were female suffrage and kind of sexual emancipation. Her views on the Soviet Union were informed initially by her kind of broader liberal outlook. She'd never been to the Soviet Union. And she was particularly, during the 1930s, became particularly more keen on the Soviet Union as a bulwark to fascism. And if you look at the biographies of Sidney and Beatrice Webb, after 1936, the Soviet Union takes on a kind of a greater importance and a greater relevance. And this is true for most of the fellow travellers. The writer David Coate just says that basically within the kind of history of the fellow travellers, there is the, he says it can be divided into PH and AH, pre-Hitler and after Hitler. So before 1933, there is a passion for the Soviet Union, and largely based on its economic and bureaucratic virtues. And after 1933, there is a love of the Soviet Union because it is a bulwark against fascism and hopefully will come to the salvation of the rest of the world. And there's an assumption, and it's a flawed assumption again, there's this assumption on the part of the fellow travellers that liberal democracy and Soviet communism can have common cause. And there is more than a hint of this assumption in the calculations of Roosevelt during World War II. And Roosevelt had garnered a lot of what he knew about the Soviet Union from various fellow travelling figures, particularly Anna Louise Strong, who was firstly guided by a strong Christian faith and then saw the kind of the realisation of her evangelical Christianity in the Soviet Union, and believed that it was really this new manifestation of God's will on earth. Malcolm Muggeridge has a rather wonderful description of Anna Louise Strong. He says that he met her at a party. She was a kind of a white-haired, florid-faced woman. And he said she possessed a kind of stupidity that was almost beautiful to behold. And certainly she's enormously naive and was eventually, after the war, she stays in Russia, and after the war, finally hounded out of the country and accused of being a foreign spy. A very traumatic episode for her, but didn't really dim her enthusiasm for the regime. Malcolm Muggeridge had travelled to the Soviet Union and had met the Webbs. He was indeed married to Beatrice Webb's niece, Kitty Muggeridge. And his disillusionment with the Soviet system saw the end to his kind of his life within the fellow traveller circles. He was one of the few journalists, him and another journalist called Gareth Jones, about who I'll talk more another time, both reported that Stalin had initiated famines in the Ukraine and Kazakhstan and beyond. And it was Malcolm Muggeridge who accused Walter Duranty, who was the real spokesman, he was a New York Times journalist and the real spokesman for Stalin. He accused Walter Duranty of being the biggest liar he had ever met. Walter Duranty was a Liverpool-born sort of Anglo-Irish American domiciled journalist who, through his, who won a Pulitzer Prize by cozying up to Stalin, and the symbiotic relationship between the two of them worked out that Duranty would give good coverage to favourable press coverage in the West to Stalin, and in return he would get the exclusives. And Duranty was prolific boozer. He'd lost one leg in an accident just after the war, and he would hold court at the Metropole Hotel, which was the great centre of socialising for the Western press corps and various diplomats within Moscow. And this strange world exists between high-level apparatchiks within the Communist Party and Western journalists, correspondents, and guest intellectuals and correspondents. At a time when the rest of there's huge famine in the rest of the country, these people live very, very well indeed. The thing about Duranty, though, is that he's kind of alone, really, in the extent of his fraudulence. Most people like Sidney and Beatrice Webb and George Bernard Shaw and a whole range of other writers and intellectuals, far too many to talk about in one short podcast, most of them were quite sincere in what they believed and generally thought that this country, Russia, that had been so backward for so long, really did need a dose of tough medicine in order to kind of jerk it into modernity. Again, as I said at the start of the podcast, the idea that this medicine should be imposed on the West seemed to be largely unnecessary in their eyes and abhorrent and frightening. Certainly something they would never have advocated. But they did think that the Russian peasant, being the brute he clearly was, could do with a bit of this medicine and some more. And unlike Duranty, approached the whole matter with largely the best of intentions. There's an interesting bit. Again, this is why I urge you to get Black Bolshevik by Harry Hayward. There's a very interesting bit within the first quarter of the book which talks about Hayward's emotional reasons for wanting to go to the Soviet Union. He had become, as a victim of white racism, as a black minority individual within a white society, had come to feel alienated from white society, feeling dispossessed, that he didn't belong, that he wasn't meant to be there, and that it led him really on a, not just an intellectual journey, but an emotional journey for a sense of kind of completion, a sense of belonging, a sense that he should, that there was a place for him in the world. Obviously, he describes it far better than I do. And the Webbs as well seem to have seem to be miserable as sin. They seem to be extremely unhappy people who are extremely pessimistic, not just about the economy of the Western world or its chances against fascism, but also they have this overall sense of decline that seems to pervade the entire era. And I think I've spoken about this before, this sense that Richard Overy talks about of the 20s and 30s being this morbid age. And they look to the Soviet Union as a kind of a solution to this, like a not only an economic but a kind of cultural solution, and project their hopes and fantasies and dreams onto it. So what in a way the Soviet Union represents to the fellow travellers is that it's this vast kind of tableau, this vast canvas upon which they can project their feelings, their ideas, their hopes, if you will. Not only was it a kind of a strange and exotic country, but also the structures of the previous regime had been swept away after 1917, and to them it was a kind of a tabula rasa, a blank page upon which in history, upon which something new could be written. And so it appealed to a lot of people in a lot of ways. And obviously, various fellow travellers picked and selected the things that they chose to see within the Russian Revolution and the new order that followed it. It just so happens that there was a whole range of things that it was convenient to ignore. Anyway, more on that another time. Apologies for the general lack of podcasting, but I've been rather busy. Some exciting developments, which I'm sure you'll find out a little bit more about. Explaining History, we've now launched a new imprint, well, two new imprints, the 20th Century Lives imprint, which should be publishing soon within the next few months, and a new series called the Century Series, which is starting off sometime next year with the Soviet century, the communist century. So there's lots of new titles coming out, and obviously I'm always on the lookout for new and upcoming writers, people that have interesting things they want to say about history, particularly modern history, specifically the 20th century. So if you've got an idea and you want to get in touch, you can get me at www.explaininghistory.com. And I'll be great to speak to you soon. Next title coming out is Red Sun at War Part 3, Fighting Back from the Coral Sea to the Kokoda Trail. So it's a tale of jungle warfare, battle on the high seas, and good daring do stuff like that. If you're interested in your military history, we've put out Darkest Hour, Finest Hour, which is Britain's experience in the critical year of 1940, and there is a new study guide now explaining the Russian Revolution. So that's going to be part of the second part of our study guide series. We've done explaining Nazi Germany, explaining the Russian Revolution, and if you're studying either of those things, those ebooks will give you targeted, concise information that will help you to absolutely smash those exams when they come. Anyway, look forward to speaking to you soon. I promise, I will try to get a slightly more regular podcast out there. But there's been a bit of a longer one for you today to make up, so do forgive me, and I'll catch you next time on the Explaining History podcast. Thank you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.